Thank you very much, Jamie. Freud's dream of a botanical monograph contains a reproach to himself for having ignored the science of botany. Nevertheless, there are at least two aspects of Freud's account of gender and sexuality that are pertinent to my current project, a study of intersections between botany and sexuality in the work of surrealist and post-surrealist artists. And I'll be talking about that in general and then looking at a specific example in the work of Helen Chadwick. The first of these two aspects of Freud is the concept of polymorphous perversity, which I hope it will emerge that there's a certain resemblance to the account of sexuality and the unconstrained sexuality of plants by comparison with the human world. The sexual instinct is defined by Freud as a psychic representative of a source of excitation arising from an organ. It corresponds to zones of the body associated with the satisfaction of primitive needs, oral and anal orifices, mucous membranes, the eye, and only later on the genitals. Accordingly, Freud states, we must regard each individual as possessing an anal eroticism, a urethral eroticism, an oral eroticism, etc. Freud posited, I'm preaching to the converted, you know all this already, of course, a state of polymorphous perversity in the infant before these multifarious component drives come under the restrictive and controlling sway of the Oedipus complex. For a number of commentators, I'm thinking especially of queer theorists, the vision of sexuality in its primordial state has encompassing the very pleasures that in adults will be denigrated as perversions or corruptions of the true reproductive function of the sexual instinct, has afforded an alternative vantage point from which to challenge these normative constructions. Female surrealist, and it's also the case, would suggest, for a number of the artists I'm interested in who engage with botanical subjects. The female surrealist artist Dorothea Tanning in Eine kleine Nachtmusik, a painting of 1943, which also belongs to Tate Modern, like Dalí's Metamorphosis of Narcissus, and I think sort of competes with it for in terms of public popularity, dramatically allies a flower motif with the unruly instinctual life of children. The tangled stems of the sunflower are like a twisted electric cable linking the flower with the two disheveled zombie-like girls, sleepwalkers in the grip of unconscious forces, one of whose hair stands on end from the energy coursing through her body. The other aspect of the Freudian account that interests us here is the notion of an innate bisexuality, a pet hypothesis of Freud's for which botany could have provided useful supporting evidence. Freud adopted this notion of bisexuality from Wilhelm Fleiss, and it is in hysterical fantasies that he seeks verification for it. The combination of masculine and feminine impulses in a single hysterical symptom affords evidence of an innately bisexual disposition. Freud instances hysterical attacks in which the patient simultaneously plays both parts in the underlying sexual fantasy. In one case which I observed, for instance, this is Freud speaking, the patient pressed her dress up against her body with one hand, as the woman, while she tried to tear it off with the other, as the man. Then, in a letter of the 1st of August 1899 to Fleiss, he declares in one of his catchier sound bites on the matter, and I quote, "Bisexuality, I'm sure you're right about it, and I'm accustoming myself to regarding every sexual act as an event between four individuals." As we shall see later, for botanists after Linnaeus, the prospect of four or even more in a bed would not raise an eyelid. I just want to sort of, you know, give you a little bit of, by way of background to the kind of trajectory, this sort of intersection between botany and gender, sexuality, before coming to surrealism itself and eventually Helen Chadwick. The Oxford English Dictionary entry for sexuality records the first usage of the word in 1797 in an article discussing Linnaeus's sexual system. Exactly a century later, in 1897, the same word acquired a new meaning, its present-day one, referring to a person's sexual orientation in an essay by the English psychologist Havelock Ellis. For a majority of the artists in my study, the link between these meanings and their historical moments is more than simply fortuitous, I'd suggest. The new method of, I should be taking care of this as well. The new method of botanical classification introduced by Carl Linnaeus was called his sexual system because it rested upon the number and arrangement of pistils and stamens. A typical flower contains both male and female sexual organs. Linnaean botany revealed sexual mores in plants markedly at variance with human ones and seemingly much freer. By the end of the 18th century, the botanical kingdom had become eroticized to the degree that its study was deemed no longer suitable for women. Erasmus Darwin's The Loves of Plants, published in 1791, a poem based upon Linnaean precepts, was the apogee of this trend. Paradoxically, the hedonistic conception of love among plants coincided with more rigid demarcations between the sexes and a stricter policing of desire in human society, as Thomas Lecoeur has shown. What was exiled from human sexual conduct took refuge in the botanical domain. For a roll call of 20th century and more recent artists, filmmakers, and even dance choreographers, botany afforded them a means to challenge the status quo of gender and sexual relations with a vivid illustration of how they could be otherwise. Move on. That image there is a frontispiece from Robert Thornton's Temple of Flora, which was published right at the end of the 18th century and sort of illustrates this idea of the botanical kingdom being sort of suffused by Eros. An alliance between botany and perverse sexuality was cemented in the visual and literary culture of the fin de siècle, which was an important point of reference for the surrealists who came afterwards, of course. This was the period when medical doctors set about identifying so-called perversions of the sexual instinct. As Michel Foucault memorably put it, such doctors botanized in the field of the pathological, bestowing strange baptismal names on the exotic species they discovered or invented. Des Esseintes, the hero of Huysmans' novel Against Nature, A Rebours in French, which was published in 1884, was, to quote the narrator, excessively fond of flowers. In order to satisfy this penchant, Des Esseintes fills a hothouse with exotic species of plants. Such is his taste for the macabre, however, that the sickly blooms he amasses resemble patients in a medical ward. Huysmans continues, the gardeners brought in still more varieties, this time affecting the appearance of factitious skin covered with a network of counterfeit veins, most of them as if ravaged by syphilis or leprosy, displayed livid patches of flesh mottled with roseola, declaring that horticulturalists are the only true artists remaining. Des Esseintes insists that nature alone would be incapable of producing such a depraved, unhealthy species. Terms of approbation in this reverse, willfully perverse aesthetic discourse. As Alan Sinfield has shown, the against nature of the novel's title, the hero's professed enjoyment of, quote, unnatural loves and perverse pleasures reverberates, albeit ambiguously, with what was then regarded as the unnatural vice of homosexuality. And the image I show here is by a contemporary British artist, Matt Collishaw, but I think, well, you know, I know because he said so, you know, directly inspired by Huysmans. Text, something that, so contemporary artists are still referring back to this sort of stuff. Botany and sexual perversity mingle in Octave Mirbeau's Torture Garden of 1899, so right at the end of the 19th century, a classic of fin de siècle decadence, the central section of which is set in an oriental prison and intersperses descriptions of exotic flowers with the most hideous tortures. In one passage explicitly referencing Linnaeus, a Chinese executioner tears off the petals of a flower to expose its sexual organs whilst explaining to the narrator and his female companion that in the plant world, a woman, the pistil, is permitted to take multiple lovers at once, the stamens, a prospect that excites her. Incidentally, it would appear that the neurosis of Freud's patient, the rat man, was triggered by reading a uniquely revolting torture involving rats, also described in the novel, though Freud doesn't mention it by name, and you know perhaps it's his you know sort of allergy to modern or you know sort of contemporary sort of works in, of art and literature that prevented him from identifying it. Okay, so moving now to surrealism, Georges Bataille's seminal essay, A Language of Flowers, published in Document, the short-lived journal in 1930, is a key point of reference for me. This article was illustrated with plant photographs by Carl Blossfeldt from the recently published volume Art Forms in Nature. It was actually published the year before in 1929. So Bataille's article kind of takes the form of a sort of response more so than a review, I'd say. Indeed, the target of Bataille's polemic is not so much a prudish Victorian language of flower symbolism as an idealist discourse of philosophical aesthetics whose key words are form and beauty. Kant, in the Critique of Judgment, written in Linnaeus's wake, enjoins us to set aside the reproductive function of flowers in order to appreciate their free beauty, and of flowers, tulips in particular, one of the examples Kant gives of free, which is to say, you know, sort of undetermined, disinterested beauty. If we are accustomed to flowers representing human ideals, Bataille says, it's because we choose to ignore that, quote, even the most beautiful flowers are spoiled in their centers by hairy sexual organs. Recalling fin de siècle authors such as Mirbeau, whom he mentions specifically, Bataille adds that, quote, there are plants so shady one is tempted to attribute to them the most troubling human perversions. To date, the presence of botanical motifs within modern art has been viewed largely through the prism of biomorphism, a notion whose formalist biases have almost certainly impeded recognition of the themes that are at the heart of my study. Bataille's subversive gesture, directing our attention back to a disavowed sexuality, resonates with very many of the surrealist artists I'm looking at present. Just say a little bit about this image on the right. In December 1933, the surrealist journal Minotaur carried an article by Maurice Heiner, a Sade scholar and surrealist fellow traveller, which proposed a new classification of the perversions. The inciting event to which the essay can be seen as responding was the very belated publication in 1931 of a first French translation of Krafft Ebing's Psychopathia Sexualis. The article mimics, in its pseudo-scientific style and classificatory impulse, the positivist science of sexology, but seeks to purge the field of the normative and moralistic assumptions that Heiner claims have hitherto blighted studies of sexuality. My interest lies in a diagram that accompanies the article, a plant whose abundant foliage is, though not exactly in the manner imagined by Mirbeau, nevertheless nourished by the perversions. Of particular interest is Heiner's enlightened attitude towards homosexuality and to what he terms bisexualism, or he also uses this term psychosexual hermaphroditism. The last, he says, far from referring, as Krafft Ebing and Moll would wish, to an incomplete inversion, realizes a complete sexual type, as shown by ontogenesis. Very jargon-ridden, while Heiner is mainly concerned with a pre-psychoanalytic tradition, he does not ignore psychoanalysis, which he says adds weight to this interpretation by demonstrating the frequency of repressed homosexual tendencies in even the most clearly heterosexually identified subjects. So he's reevaluating in now positive terms the notion of bisexuality and also, to an extent, homosexuality, problematic as that was for the surrealists, as we know. Okay, so in order to sort of illustrate these ideas, I've chosen a particular work by the British artist Helen Chadwick, her piece Flowers, one of which we see on the right there. They were made in 1991-92. She herself died very tragically in the mid-1990s. She was a sort of rising star in the sort of contemporary artistic firmament. As I say, these works date, these particular works date from the early 1990s. I would hesitate to call Chadwick a surrealist, though her work shares many affinities with surrealism, and it is clear that she was reading the same sources as myself, including Bataille, in the late 1980s and early 1990s, when I was a postgraduate student writing my PhD in this field. The eclipse of Greenbergian modernism in the visual arts saw a resurgence of concerns with the body and with subjectivity, and of course also the rise of feminism and an art practice informed by it was another important factor here. This eclipse, as it were, of modernism caused many artists to look afresh at surrealism and gave it a new cogency in these decades, 1970s, 80s, well, really up to the present, I think. I first saw Chadwick's Piss Flowers in the exhibition Effluvia at the Serpentine Gallery in 1994, where the seesaw of attraction-repulsion that one associates with Bataille's writing was very much in evidence. Immediately upon entering the gallery, one was aware of the overpowering and to a degree nauseating smell from a molten chocolate fountain that was sort of, bubbling rather obscenely, and which sort of illustrates the cover of the catalogue. The piss flowers themselves have a strangely seductive beauty that belies the evidence of how they were produced and their association with one particular bodily fluid, namely urine. The multimedia character of this exhibition, which included sort of sculptures, backlit photographs, this chocolate fountain, and so on, with its appeal to several senses, to sort of vision, sound, smell, and so forth, can be seen as a direct challenge to Clement Greenberg's contention that pure opticality, those are his words, is the proper domain of visual art. So that's the sort of larger context, I'd say, for this work. The The piss flowers themselves were the outcome of an artist residency at Banff Centre for the Arts in Alberta, Canada, somewhere that's evidently very cold. The piss flowers are casts of the cavities made by Chadwick and her partner David Notarius peeing into the snow. You can guess which one's which, I think. If you can't, you shouldn't be a psychoanalyst. But, where am I? Okay, so the resultant casts, a merger of male and female urine streams, when turned upright, miraculously resembled the pistil and stamens of a flower. And what I show you at the bottom there is a diagram which I took from one of the many books about flowers in Helen Chadwick's library, which is now held by the Henry Moore Institute in Leeds. And it's a schematic, the caption explains it's a schematic diagram of a perfect or bisexual flower in which the petals and sepals are free, that is, not united. So, going back to the point that I made before, a typical flower, you know, sort of combines both male and female sexual parts. It's sort of hermaphroditic, as it Chadwick accompanied these works with a poem. At least she, you know, sort of wrote a poem at the same as, you know, as she was undertaking this project, in which it's, you know, sort of very clear that she was aware of Linnaeus and the kinds of marital and sexual metaphors that he used, and it's slightly irreverent, mocking in character towards those. So the process of creating the work, one gains the impression of something that was fun, enjoyable, playful, and improvisational in the way that child's play is, can be seen as retaining traces of a pleasure that Freud ascribes to an infant's polymorphous perversity, in this case, a pleasure and creativity associated with the act of voiding urine. And the quotation there is the one that I read out, Freud's account of the polymorphously perverse character of the sexual instinct. So as I've shown, an operation of inversion, a formal operation of inversion is fundamental to the production of the piss flowers, recognition of which I think is key to the radically subversive character of these works and to their polemical contestation of gender and sexual norms. And I think, you know, sort of all these meanings of inversion, which I've listed here, are relevant to what's going on in these works. The diagram on the side is Chadwick's own records of the various piss flowers. I think there are about maybe a dozen of them in total, and show the curvaceous plinths, which, you know, sort of by contrast with the flowers, are quite sort of, the flowers themselves are quite sort of smooth and polished, that the flowers were, the piss flowers were placed on. So the first meaning of inversion, a turning upside down, I think, is it's sort of obvious. How that might be relevant to work that has a kind of subversive undercutting impulse, at least towards modernism, and it's to the aesthetic of purity that one finds, you know, sort of from Kant through to Greenberg, who was, you know, sort of very Kantian in his formation. Inversion can also mean a turning outside in, introversion, and I'll come back to this in a short while, because that is highly relevant as well. It's the meaning comes from obstetrics in particular. It can also mean diversion to an improper purpose, perversion. And, of course, it's also, in the late 19th century, a synonym for homosexuality. The example given as Beardsley from 1895. So all of these meanings are evoked by this formal operation that lies at the basis of the work, I would contend. Thomas Le Coeur, who I mentioned earlier in his book Making Sex, Body and Gender from the Greeks to Freud, which was published in 1990, a couple of years before the Piss Flowers, brilliantly demonstrated how a one-sex model based on similarity is displaced by a model of incommensurable differences between the sexes, a transformation that he argues occurs from, you know, roughly the 18th century. Prior to that, the female reproductive tract was represented by anatomists such as Vesalius as interiorized within the body, that is, introjected or inverted in the sense that we saw earlier, but essentially analogous to the main one. I kind of hoped that I could find evidence in the archive of Helen Chadwick's interest in these ideas, and I was talking to the librarian, the archivist at the Henry Moore Institute, and saying, oh, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if she had a copy of it? And as I was saying that, I was sort of looking over her shoulder, and my eye caught Chadwick's copy of Le Coeur's book, which, as chance would have it, had sort of underlinings that rather beautifully confirmed my suppositions about her intellectual motivations. So at the same time, she was also interested in Foucault's publication of the memoir of Urquiline Babin, a 19th century hermaphrodite, in which Foucault, in his introduction, evokes this idea of a happy limbo of non-identity before Babin was medically assigned to the male sex and subsequently committed suicide. So Chadwick, similarly, I think, in this kind of merger of botany with these other interests, is evoking, perhaps in a somewhat sort of utopian mode, a kind of freedom and sort of constraint from the rigid, as she saw it, sort of dimorphism of human gender relations, and the sort of botany offered her the example, Linnaean botany offered her the example of something different. A student working on Helen Chadwick, under my direction, discovered sort of very interestingly that she was collaborating with the Terence Higgins Trust and other AIDS charities from the 1980s, and presumably, at the time when she made the Piss Flowers as well, something obviously pertinent to the series of viral landscapes, works that explore the instability and permeability of boundaries that the scholar of AIDS literatures, Monica Pearl, has argued was a consequence of the experience of AIDS. I think, one can see this proto-queer aspect of Chadwick's practice, the contestation or, sort of disruption of a sort of, bounded subjectivity, a kind of, playing with and sort of instability of identity as consonant with her interest in abjection, which likewise is understood, for instance, by Julia Kristeva as threatening the bounded body and self. So, to my last slide, you'll be glad to know. The continued resonance of Bataille's language of flowers, in particular its queer potential, was shown by a program of live performances curated by Lee Adams and Ron Athey, while Dawn Addis's 2006 Undercover Surrealism exhibition was in situ at the Hayward Gallery. Dawn had to leave, unfortunately, but I wanted to make a little homage to her. She's been a great inspiration to me over many years. Adams's performance took place in a section of the show devoted to Bataille's language of flowers. And I think, forgetting to move on. And I think you can see the Blossfeld illustrations around the walls. The flower plume suspended from the ceiling that appears to blossom from the artist's upended backside was made up of Anthurium, Oriental Casablanca lilies, dahlias, and roses. The artist himself told me this, and it, you know, kind of evokes once again Wiesmann and that whole decadent vogue for exotic flowers. A plinth of high density foam covered with red velvet had roses studded around the edge that may be a specific allusion to an episode concerning Sade that Bataille recounts in the essay Language of Flowers. Similar to Athey's performance titled Solar Anus, its title taken directly from an essay by Bataille, Adams renegotiates the semiotics of the anus, which in the 1980s had become a synecdoche as never before for the abjected death-bound gay. Bataille is just one of multiple affirmative points of reference within a surrealist language of flowers. Pierre Molinier, I think, is another, for a practice attuned to queer politics in a post-AIDS era. Thank you.